From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley at member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump reiterated his support of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh on Twitter this morning after Democrats called for Kavanaugh to be impeached because of new allegations of sexual assault published by the New York Times in an essay and also a forthcoming book. Trump tweeted that Kavanaugh's accusers should be sued. And finger-pointing over those drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities continues. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blames Iran. The president says, we'll see. What else should we be watching? NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here. Ron, good Monday to you.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Yeah, and the newest Kavanaugh accusation, it has a somewhat of a caveat. The essay by the reporters was published in the New York Times. The Times later issued an editor's note that one of the alleged victims declined to be interviewed and did not recall one of the incidents. Someone else saw it. So walk us through this.
You know, we are hearing a lot of Democrats suddenly calling for impeachment of Brett Kavanaugh, and it's largely for the same reason that they're calling for impeachment of the president, Robin. They know that Mitch McConnell and his Republican Senate majority are not going to go along with either of those impeachments. They want the process, though, and they want the probe, the investigation that would go with it. It would be a chance to make the case against Kavanaugh, which is to some degree revived, renewed by this New York Times story. It does not break a lot of really new ground, but it does bring back talk about witnesses and what they recall. So they would like to make that case against Kavanaugh, as they would like an impeachment process to make the case against President Trump. It would have great visibility. And some of these Democrats who are calling for this are running for president. Not to question their sincerity, but they are speaking to primary voters and caucus goers. And this is the backdrop to everything that's happening in Washington right now.
Well, the Democratic candidates Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris have called for Kavanaugh's impeachment. Again, that means a trial. But Senator Harris told Morning Edition that this goes back, beyond these recent allegations. Even his Supreme Court hearing was flawed.
There's not been an investigation with the level of attention that normally would occur around these kinds of allegations, and especially related to the subject at hand, which is the appropriateness of this individual serving on the highest court of our land for a lifetime appointment.
But Ron, Kamala Harris also acknowledged that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, as you said, wouldn't convict Kavanaugh. Are they going out on a limb, or as you say, do they believe that this will shine a light just to be a reminder to people of questions?
It is the latter. It is a matter of shining a light. And this is going to come back every time another witness surfaces over time. Perhaps the most important part of the New York Times investigation is the further evidence that the FBI, while it did investigate to some degree and talk to some of these people, it did not respond to all of the evidence that was presented and did not talk to everyone or respond to everything that was brought to them, particularly in the latter part of the investigation that followed the Senate hearings. So, look, let's be clear. Impeachment happens in the House. You have a discussion there in committee and on the floor. You have a vote. But unless the Senate upholds that impeachment with a two-thirds majority, it ends there. Yeah. That's what happened with Bill Clinton 2 decades ago. No one thinks that this Republican Senate is going to muster the votes to convict either Brett Kavanaugh or President Trump on the basis of anything we know now.
I just want to ask you quickly, this seeming reduction in volume from President Trump on Iran, Mike Pompeo saying Iran was definitely behind that attack in Saudi Arabia, Iran denying it, and today President Trump tweeting out, we'll see.
You know, we do sense some frustration here on the part of the president. He had seemed to resolve the conflict among his advisors on Iran. The biggest hawk, John Bolton, the national security advisor, went out the window last week. Mm-hmm. But now we see this attack, highly sophisticated and successful, perhaps beyond the capability of the rebel Houthis in Yemen who claimed credit. Naturally, suspicion falls on Iran, as Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has said. He says there's intelligence that says so. We haven't seen that evidence yet. But they are the sponsoring power behind the Houthis. Bottom line, the president feels the need to talk tough on Twitter again. We got the locked and loaded tweet. Mm-hmm. Then he says, we'll see. You'll recall in 2017, he threatened North Korea with fire and fury like the world had never seen. Then mm-hmm. he made friends with Kim Jong-un. And now North Korea tests missiles and nothing happens. We are lost somewhere in the mind of Donald Trump.
NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
In a conversation with President Trump over the weekend, Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer warned that any firearm legislation that falls short of universal background checks would, quote, not get the job done. One group against universal background checks is the National Rifle Association, which met in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. Joining us now is Rob Pincus. He is a member of the NRA and attended the group's gathering. He's also a spokesperson for Save the Second, a pro-gun rights group that is pushing for reform inside of the NRA. And Rob, we spoke with you last month after the shakeup on the NRA board, and you were there in Washington to get answers about what's going on within the higher brass. Did you get the answers you were looking for?
Honestly, we didn't. We unfortunately had a confirmation experience as members of the NRA and certainly as members of Save the Second. We went to the board meetings this year hoping that we would get some answers and hoping that we'd at least see some indication from the leadership at the National Rifle Association that they were listening to the members. And what we found was that not only were we not welcome at the board meeting, but we really weren't engaged at all by the leadership. We were pretty well dismissed. And it was clear that they are very much talking in an echo chamber right now. Some individual directors engaged us, and there are several directors on the board who are speaking out in interest for independent audit and interest in change, interest in reform, interest in engaging the members. But as an organization, the NRA remains tone deaf.
And you mentioned some of the issues that you wanted to take up during that meeting. That is some of the way the money is spent, and also listening to members when it comes to gun control. So we just heard that there's a push for legislation for universal background checks. Do you feel that the NRA is actually listening to the members when it comes to exactly what members want in the form of gun legislation?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're in a position right now where we're trying to get the NRA to listen to the members on a much larger organizational structure issue. The leadership of the NRA, the messaging of the NRA, the tone of the NRA, not just the legislative agenda or the political activities of the NRA. Ultimately, I think most American gun owners, certainly the NRA and the vast majority of members, agree that universal background checks or ending private transfers isn't an answer to solving crime or ending gun-related deaths. But the structure of the NRA and the trust that the NRA has from the membership is really the issue for us. It's a question of whether we support the NRA financially and in action and in word, or do we move our support to other state-level and national-level gun rights organizations, of which there are many doing great work around the country.
You were actually physically kicked out of the meeting over the weekend?
Well, what happens is board meetings will sometimes go into executive session. And obviously, there's some very good reasons to go into executive session. Unfortunately, it's the tone, the tenor, and the manner in which the members, not just me, but all of the attending members were treated during those moments. For example, I was not even allowed to leave a very small area where I basically had a private security escort because I was the only member out of 5 million in attendance on Thursday. Mm. On Friday, we had more members show up. On Saturday, we had many more members show up. But once again, we were not allowed by security presence to have any access to the board members, although some individual board members did engage us. Ted Nugent actually stood up at one point and objected on behalf of the members in attendance to going into executive session, asking that more be shared with us about what was really going on.
Hmm. The last time we spoke with you, you mentioned how disheartened you were by what's happening within the organization and the possibility in the future that you might leave the organization. Now that you've been to this meeting, how are you feeling?
Well, because of the response we've gotten from the membership, we had a very similar response after the members' meeting back in April. When we stood up, several of us stood up and challenged the board at the time when members are allowed to address the board, the members' meeting, which happens once per year. Many, many people came out and said, we didn't even know we could do that. I have no more faith than I did a few months ago. In fact, I might have less faith right now in the leadership of the NRA after seeing what they did in terms of treating the members the way they did and showing no signs of even acknowledging many aspects of the current crisis during the board meetings. But I have a great deal of faith inside of the American gun community. You know, the gun owners of America are the gun lobby, not the NRA, certainly not Wayne LaPierre. And I think a lot of people are waking up to that, and they're going to be taking more action in the future, not only supporting Save the Second, but also taking action directly to let the NRA know that they need to reform.
And we want to mention that we're hearing gunshots behind you. You're actually at a gun range in Boylston, Massachusetts, at a meeting there, correct?
I am. I'm about to start 4 days of training in support of Gun Owners Action League, which is a state-level gun rights organization that I've worked with to support for years. And my primary vocation is firearms defensive shooting educator. So I'm actually out here with about 15 students with the Gun Owners Action League, and we're going to kick off a four-day program just as soon as I get off this call.
That's Rob Pincus. He is a longtime NRA member and spokesperson for a pro-gun rights group called Save the Second that's working on reform inside of the NRA. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya.
And we reached out to the NRA for comment and have not heard back yet.
All this week, we will be reporting on what some publications are calling the climate crisis. As part of the Covering Climate Now initiative, over 250 press outlets worldwide, we'll hear the science, air, land, water, but also the personal impact. So many questions, including how to talk about climate change with people who are climate science deniers. Well, one approach, a friendly advice column, an interaction on a personal level. Journalist Sarah Peach launched the Ask Sarah Climate Change advice column and ask people to reach out to her on social media with their questions. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. She's also a senior editor at the Yale Climate Connections. And Sarah Peach joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So what inspired this?
Well, a few different things. But as you said, I'm a journalist. I've been covering climate change for almost 10 years now. And because people in my life, friends and family, started to realize that I knew something about climate change. One thing that happened was that people came to me with their questions. I started to get questions like, should I put solar panels on my roof? Should I buy a beach house on the Outer Banks? And so that was part of the inspiration for formalizing my answers to those questions. So now anyone can send a question to me about climate change, and I will do my best to go and talk to the experts and bring back an answer for you.
Right. Well, and people are also asking you, we understand, how do I talk to my family member who doesn't believe that there is climate change or doesn't believe that it's man-made? Let's start there. What's the answer?
I think it's important to evaluate how open-minded they are. We know from research data that almost 70% of Americans think that climate change is happening, and a lot of them are aware of it and concerned, but aren't necessarily doing much about it. So as an advice columnist, I would say that your time and energy is much better spent talking with those people about the problem. And if the person is just really quite sure that it's not an issue, then just let them go.
Well, but that's hard.
Yes,
for people.
I know.
I mean, here's one letter that you got. Dear Sarah, my friend is a Republican who owns a very expensive mansion on Fisher Island in Miami. I'm fairly sure my friend believes that climate change is real, but doesn't know how serious it is for her or in her children's lifetimes. What year will I tell her is the last I'll be able to visit her there because it'll be underwater? How many years ahead of that will she need to sell it before it'll be rendered worthless? I'm thinking of getting her a garden gnome wearing a snorkel. And you write, let's start with the facts, and you start with sea level rise. Like, what did you tell this person?
Yeah, so I think that what people have to understand is that long before South Florida washes away, potentially, with sea level rise, people are going to start selling their homes and moving away, and home values are going to decrease, and quality of life is going to decrease. And so I encourage this letter writer to talk to her friend about it, to ask her some questions like, are you being affected by this now? How have you seen floods in your day-to-day life? And just open up a conversation, because this isn't a distant problem. It's here and now.
Oh, here and now. Yes. In one of the suggestions that you make, because this is what you do, you write several paragraphs of what the science is, and then you have suggestions, and you say, I keep daydreaming about what would happen if you scheduled a visit to your friend to coincide with a king tide and street flooding and used that as a conversation starter. And then you say the date of the full moon in September or October, when the alignment of the sun, the earth, and the moon give an extra tug to the tides. You know, maybe visit then when it's at its worst. Because you say we have to start talking. You and your colleagues define something called the climate change spiral of silence. Right. What's that?
So in surveys, people will say that on a day-to-day basis, they hardly ever hear their friends and family talking about this issue. So we read the news, we think that this is a real problem, but we're just kind of quietly worrying about it by ourselves instead of talking in our community about it. And I think that is just so harmful to our chances of doing something about the problem. Because it's one of the most important things that anyone can do is actually to speak up to friends and family and say, I'm worried about this. Are you worried about it?
Yeah. There's a woman who wrote you, you know, how do I talk to my children? They're toddlers now. You know, this woman, I think, jokingly said to you, should I teach them how to can food? And you responded, well, maybe.
Yeah.
So you talk about some of the personal ways, you know, some people are, you know, taking people on dives to the Great Barrier Reef, or there's maybe an evangelical Christian who believes in climate change, you know, speaks of her faith and climate change in the same sentence. How else are people doing this on a personal level?
I'll give you an example. A lot of people really do love their pets. And one thing that can happen in a natural disaster, as we're seeing more extreme weather related to climate change, is that people get separated from their pets, or they don't want to evacuate because they don't want to leave their pets behind, or pets end up in shelters. And so if you can talk about climate change and maybe connect your concern about extreme weather to people's love and devotion for their pets, or something else very personal like that, I think that can wake people up and help invite them to enter the conversation in a different way, rather than just sort of automatically defaulting into something about Al Gore or Donald Trump.
What are some of the other questions that you've had?
So, for example, I got one question from a woman living in Boston who was wondering if one day malaria could spread to her city, and wondered if she should do something to protect her family. I've had questions like, will there be famines in the United States in the near future? And then I get another set of questions that are really about, how do I talk about this? How do I bring climate change up during small talk at social gatherings? What kind of car should I get? What's the best car for the climate?
By the way, people who ask you, should I buy that beach house? What do you say?
You know, I think that if it's your heart's desire, I'm not going to say, no, don't do that. But you need to understand the risks and think about the homes that people lost during the Great Recession and how many homes lost a lot of value, and be prepared that something similar could happen to your beach home. And unlike the case in the Great Recession, the value may never come back, because the house itself, even if it doesn't go underwater, if the roads connecting to it go underwater, the cost of insuring the place will go up. And so it may not be the investment that it was in the past.
Well, it's interesting, and even hearing you now, you didn't say, scientists project that sea level, because of sea level rise and the melting glaciers, and that there's, you said, the road to your house might be flooded, which is a much more graspable notion.
Yes. I think that you've really hit on the key to this, that an advice column invites people into this topic in a different way, on a very personal one-to-one. And it's not about making accusations or saying that people are wrong. It's just, the reality is that each of us will have to deal with this issue in the future and even right now.
I want to go back to the mother who asked you, what should I tell my kids? And it was just kind of heartbreaking, because you know, she joked that there are two now, but according to projections, they're going to be dealing with these effects on a very serious level when they grow up. And you advised, and I want to give some of your advice because it's so good. NASA has a climate website for children. You list some books. We'll put them at our website, herenow.org. But also, you spoke to another science journalist who said, talk about climate change the way you'd approach the subject of sex. They'll let you know when they don't want to know anymore. They'll let you know how much they can take in.
Yeah. So this is the science writer, Michelle Niehaus. I think she had some really great advice, which was you need to answer their questions about climate change, because that's one of the most important things you can do as a parent to prepare your children for climate change is even simply letting them know that it exists and that it will affect them.
You remind this mother that in 2018, the roads were blocked to Wilmington, North Carolina because of Hurricane Florence. So people there had to know how to survive a few days on their own with canned foods and flashlights. And you can extrapolate from that. If there's a longer interruption, your kids might want to know how to garden, preserve food, safely gather and filter water, make repairs to a damaged home, sew clothing, provide medical care, use self-defense techniques, and more. That's a chilling sentence right there.
Yes, it is. But no human being can know all of those skills. And so what is even more important is teaching your kids how to get along with others, because we rely on others all the time for medical care and to make repairs. And so what can help your kids become more resilient is just trusting that they will be part of a community and helping them learn how to work well within that community.
Sarah Peach, senior editor at Yale Climate Connections. And also, she writes the monthly climate change advice column, Ask Sarah. We'll link you up at herenow.org. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And our talk with Sarah is part of Covering Climate Now. This is a collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world. We will link you to Sarah's column, but also, what would you like to see us cover about climate change? What questions do you want us to try to answer? Let us know, hereandnow.org. Oil prices spiked this morning after the drone attacks Saturday on a critical oil facility in Saudi Arabia. Global oil futures briefly spiked 20% before falling back down to just under 9%. Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen claimed responsibility. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is blaming Iran. Jill Schlesinger joins us. She's the business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, who joins us every week. And we love having you here, Jill. There have been other attacks. We're going to get to that. And if we could put aside the politics, because we're covering that elsewhere, how big a deal is this attack on markets?
You know, I think it is a pretty big deal. And as you said, you know, it's 5% of global production. But, you know, Saudi Arabia does supply the world with about 12% of crude, the biggest exporter of oil. And maybe this might put this into perspective, how big a deal it is. You know, when you think about the losses in 1979 with the Islamic Revolution, or in 1999, back to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, that's what we're talking about. Going back to, you know, decades ago, before seeing such a big, huge impact on the world oil markets.
Yeah. Well, President Trump tweeted Sunday that he authorized a potential release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Remind people what that is, and did that cheer the markets? Didn't seem to.
Well, you know what? In some respects, it did immediately. So I'll start with the second part of that question first. And that is that, when I woke up in the middle of the night, the crude oil market was down 20%. And then there was a tweet about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which then the markets kind of came back, down about 10%, maybe now 15% now. So here's the deal. In a Strategic Petroleum Reserve, there's about 600 million barrels that are held in case of an emergency. And a lot of different countries have these kinds of reserves. And I think that the bottom line is that there will not be an oil shortage or a gas shortage here in the United States. That's what's important to really reiterate. We could see a price hike, but we're not talking about shortages and lines to get your gas.
Yeah, but what if there are more attacks? Because as we mentioned, there have been many. This was big, but there have been many.
Well, I think that that's part of the uncertainty that is swirling around the actual crude oil and Brent oil markets right now, because as these attacks become more frequent, then all of a sudden you've got an undermining of Saudi Arabia's ability to produce oil consistently. And of course, they're trying to get production back online, but that could take weeks. And that may be the best case scenario week. So we have to really keep an eye on how much they're getting back online and how quickly.
Well, and also tensions in the region. The Wall Street Journal reporting that Saudi Arabian officials may delay the IPO for Aramco. That's the Saudi Arabian Oil Corporation. And, you know, this is a very wealthy country, but that's going to hurt. You have Iran saying, yeah, well, the sanctions against us, even though we abided by the nuclear agreement, they hurt, you know. Your thoughts on that, the region?
Well, you know, I think that these things are temporary. And what I'm actually much more concerned about, frankly, is what is the impact on consumers right now? Here in the U.S., if we see gas prices go up 10, maybe 20 cents a gallon, that's not going to prevent somebody from curtailing the way they shop. But if this were to persist, and as we come into the fourth quarter and the holiday shopping season, yes, we are exactly 100 days away from Christmas right now, that could be quite unnerving and not good for our economy.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. Jill, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
What happens when Ronald McDonald walks into a poor immigrant neighborhood in the south of France and sets off a supersized revolution? The story of how a company slogan to sell more shakes and burgers became a rallying cry for workers in France. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
There are many paths to parenthood, and every year thousands of Americans choose the route of adoption. But when Nefertiti Austin, a single Black woman, chose to adopt, she ran into a host of systemic and cultural barriers. Though she was able to bring home a baby boy, which she named August, she says she faced continual questions about her ability to raise a Black son. Austin explores all of this in her new book, Motherhood So White, a memoir of race, gender, and parenting in America. Nefertiti, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Before we get started, let's talk about your story and your genesis for deciding to adopt. So it was 2006. You were a single woman, a writer living in L.A., Beverly Hills.
Yes.
When you made this conscious decision to formally adopt instead of having a biological child, what were some of the reasons why?
Well, I was raised by my grandparents, and I think having that experience of being raised by people who had not given birth to me kind of set me on a path to, well, if someone could do that for me, I could do that for someone else. And my best friend is adopted. She's also an adoption social worker. So for years, I had been hearing about all of these children who needed homes. And it had been in the back of my mind for a while. And I wanted to be married, and I wanted to have a family the traditional route. But I was very open to wanting to adopt, and I felt that that was really important to give back and to do that first.
And you found this in your journey to coming to a formal adoption. So you decided to adopt. You received lots of mixed responses from family and friends.
Yes.
You say in the book, quote, adopting a child, I did not know I was breaking the code.
Yes.
What exactly is the code?
Well, essentially, Black people tend to adopt people we know. So we are seeking a point of reference. We adopt within our families. So typically we start there. Nieces, nephews, cousins, extended family members. We have a very large Christian faith in our community that's very important to us. So if a church member has a niece or nephew who's got a child who needs assistance, we want to step up and help. And so typically that is the path that we pursue, as opposed to going outside of your family, going outside of your known community to become a parent.
You also write, not only did white people believe it
nonsense the media spread about kids, specifically in the foster care system, Black people did too. So that played a role as well in choosing children that you knew that were a known quantity.
Absolutely. Because when you know the family, you know the father or the mother's had some challenges, for some reason we either give it a pass or we figure, okay, I can deal with that. I know what that's about. But it's a whole nother dynamic when you give in to rumors and myths and lies really about the children, that they're damaged, they're crack babies, they are going to grow up and become these domestic terrorists within society. The prevailing narrative is that there's something wrong with the system, therefore there is something wrong with these children.
Once you were able to adopt your son,
yes,
you went out, you were searching for books and mommy groups and those types of things, and you didn't find books that really spoke to what you wanted. Can you explain a little bit about what you went to look for and what you found and why the distinction is important to you in finding books specific to your experience as a Black mother?
Well, before I actually started the process and I knew I was ready to do so, my go-to is information always. Mm-hmm. So I'm on the internet, I'm at the library. And so even before I had finished the process, I realized, wow, I don't see myself in any of these pages. The mommy wars were really popular at that point. And I'm like, well, I have nothing to contribute to that conversation. And it began to crystallize, especially once August came home, that there were no narratives for a single Black woman who had adopted. Mm. And it infuriated me that whenever a white starlet adopted a child, it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is so great. And there were all of these people who were doing that on a daily basis, and especially women who look like me. And we were just erased from the conversation. We didn't exist even within the adoption community. So it was important to me because there was a distinction. I didn't make the distinction. Yeah. I just kind of walked into the distinction and learned that I was in the margins.
Let's talk a little bit more about those distinctions, because uh-huh. I know a lot of folks listening might be thinking, well, isn't the act of mothering a race-neutral act?
It could be race-neutral, but when Trayvon Martin is murdered by a vigilante in the street and Tamir Rice is murdered for playing with a toy gun, it's political, it's racial, and it has been, I mean, for hundreds of years at this particular point. And if Black mothers could just parent and not be worried about their child having a Nerf gun fight on the front lawn and could securely feel that, oh, yeah, my child can do what Jacob does or what Johnny does, then it would be race neutral. Mm-hmm. But of course, we know that that is definitely not the case. Our kids are perceived as behavior problems. They are considered aggressive, but their white counterpart is considered rambunctious. And our girls are sexualized at an early age. They are thought to have attitudes. But if another girl, a white girl, says the same thing or responds in like manner, it's, oh, well, she was annoyed, or it's excused. Mm-hmm. And so many of our actions have a negative attachment to it that isn't our doing. Mm-hmm. And so then we're stuck with having to explain, well, this is how the person was feeling, or this is why they responded in the way. It's like, I feel like we spend so much time explaining, oh, this is how I felt, this is what I was thinking, because it is assumed that I'm coming from a negative place just because my skin is Black.
As part of your book, you talk a lot about the myth of Black male hypermasculinity.
Right.
It's something that you're hyper aware of.
My grandfather was very stoic, and so his idea of affection was a pat on the back. So when my son was 3 or 4, we were visiting my grandparents, and I'm telling him, oh, handshake and a hug. And my grandfather very formally said, men do not hug. And I thought, oh my God, here we go. We're going to start this emotional distance within our family, within our community. Again, here's another generation of that about to happen. And it's extremely problematic. I mean, there's so many men who are taught to hold their emotions in check. Yeah. And I think that all of that, it bottles up. Mm-hmm. And at some point,
and it becomes toxic.
Very toxic. It makes people sick. People die young. And it definitely hampers relationships between men and women. And that camaraderie that boys need with other boys is, damage isn't the right word, but maybe they can't really reach that emotional intimacy that women have, that girls have with each other, where they could really talk about, it hurt my feelings when, and someone else can say, you know what, I had that same experience, you're not alone, and let's see how we can work through this together.
Raising a son as a Black mother, you received all sorts of advice. You actually have this story in your book where you were mansplained while getting your son August a haircut. What do these interactions say? And in many ways, we think that they're just trying to help. But also, you think it says something bigger about the perception of you as a single Black woman raising a son.
Yes. Sometimes the comments I felt either stemmed from their fears about, oh, wow, you've got this child and you're by yourself, and or you have a child and you don't know anything about his people. That was a big one. And, you know,
meaning his birth family.
His birth family. So, you know, good luck with that. Or, okay, you need to make sure that he gets his hair cut every 2 weeks, as if that somehow will improve his character if his hair is not cut every 2 weeks like clockwork. So it's funny.
Yeah. At the end of your book, you have profiles of other Black women who have chosen to adopt. What is your message to other Black mothers out there who may be listening, who are thinking about taking on this journey of adopting a Black child?
Well, I definitely hope that anyone thinking about it will know that it can absolutely be done. I mean, I've gone from free-spirited person to I'm actually a planner. I feel like a real grown-up now. And certainly if I can do it, any other Black woman considering it can do it, should do it, and not rely on or get caught up in what other people say. Because I think we still have a lot of fear in our community about raising children and what they think and how they perceive us. And I think that if we have narratives about people who look like us, that it just gives, I think, more power behind that decision that we want to make.
Nefertiti Austin, author of Motherhood So White, a memoir of race, gender, and parenting in America. Nefertiti, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we have an excerpt of the book at hereandnow.org.
She's my best friend's girl.
Rick Ocasek, that's how he said it, though most of us said Ocasek, co-founder and lead singer of the 70s and 80s band The Cars, has died. He was in his 70s. It was in the 1970s that the band burst on the scene.
I guess you're just what I need. Just what I needed. I needed someone to feed.
The late bass player and singer Ben Orr and Ocasek met in Cleveland in the early 70s. Fittingly, the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year in Cleveland, although guitarist Elliot Easton thanked a Boston DJ.
In the very early days of the band, we had an angel in the form of a lady named Maxanne Sartori. A top DJ at WBCN in Boston from the city's biggest FM rock station. And Maxanne did an amazing thing. She began to play our demo tape in heavy rotation alongside all the biggest records of the day. So that really got the attention of the A&R staffs and labels, and representatives of major labels started flying up to Boston from New York to check out this band, The Cars, whose demo tape got so much airplay that it was actually being reported on a national level. Maxanne did that, and we will forever be indebted to her for her incredible support in getting this thing going.
Well, Maxanne launched The Cars, but our next guest was one of those who went on the ride, former Boston Globe rock critic Jim Sullivan. He's in the studio with us. And Jim, Rick Ocasek, that gangly look, that warbly voice, his dad was a systems analyst for NASA. He had a very cerebral, you know, kind of sense about him. Just talk about how different he was in the music scene.
Well, he stood out physically, certainly, as we know, very tall and kind of gangly and, as some said, kind of praying mantis-like almost in some ways. What the Cars did was they entered during the punk and new wave era in Boston, the Boston clubs, but there was a sort of detached cool about them and about him where there was some irony, the emotions were a little bit icy, there was some Black humor in some of the songs, and They sort of infiltrated the mainstream in one of the first bands to do so.
Well, I was thinking it was sort of like a Trojan horse because he was very avant-garde, and yet they had this poppy sound. And you asked David Robinson about this.
Yeah, David Robinson, the Cars drummer, told me we did not want the music to be so artsy that you could not understand it, but we wanted it to be artistic. Yeah. And I thought that was a good description. There's another one from Greg Hawks, the keyboard player. I asked him, how would you describe the Cars to somebody who's young, who just never knew them? And he said, well, for lack of an intelligent answer, I'd say we were one of the new wave bands that at least framed us in with the Police, Talking Heads, Devo, and the Pretenders. New wave is not my favorite term, but I'm used to it. And for historical purposes, yeah, the Cars were a new wave band.
Okay, let's listen to some more, because their first album, The Cars, sold 6 million copies. Their music video for Double Life was one of the first to air on VH1. And here's another radio hit, Good Times Roll. The Cars broke up in 1988, but Rick Ocasek went on to produce Weezer, No Doubt, Bad Religion. Weezer, by the way, tweeted out that they are devastated by the loss of their friend and mentor. They'll forever cherish the precious times we got to work and hang out. A lot of people don't know about Rick Ocasek's producing.
Yeah, he actually started doing that fairly early on with the Cars. I mean, that was kind of his side job, and maybe if you want to call it this way, his give back to the rest of the music world. And he produced a lot of bands that were certainly under the Cars in terms of popularity, or people just didn't know so much about them. One of the best was the band Suicide, mm-hmm. For some problematic synthesizer bass band that the Cars brought on tour with them, and Rick also produced their records. And he's mm-hmm. got a long list of bands that he worked with.
Jim Sullivan, what else would you want us to know today about Rick?
A friend of mine, Steve Wynn, the guitar player and singer for the band Dream Syndicate, he said the Cars were about as cool as a mainstream band as you could find back then. Cool because they connected to the masses while remaining subversive and weird and angular and dark mm-hmm. and teasingly distant. And then there was one other thing Ocasek said, actually, to Rolling Stone way back in 1980 to Michael Gilmore. What he said was, we did have a certain view of the world, sort of cold, but hysterical.
Jim Sullivan, former Boston Globe rock critic, as we listen to a song that Rick Ocasek wrote, but was sung by the late Ben Orr, kind of a tribute to both of them. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.